me. He was getting angry. What matter? They are my people. You are only a madwoman, come to plague good people on midwinter night. At least I wasn't planning to kill any of them. He did not reply, but cold air rushed through the bathhouse, setting the candle flames to swaying. There was little space in that outer room. They were almost shouting in each other's faces. The crack in his defenses widened. She could not reason away whatever magic kept him forgetful, but emotion dragged his memory a little nearer the surface. So did her touch. So did her blood. The feeling between them was still there. He did not need to remember. He felt it, just as she did. And he had brought her here. Despite all he'd said, he had brought her here. Her skin felt thin, as though a breath would bruise it. Vasya had always been reckless in battle. That same recklessness had her in its grip now. Deeper than memory, she thought. Mother of God, forgive me. She reached out. Her hand, with its white scars, paused a breath from his cheek. His hand shot up. His fingers closed on her wrist. For a second, they stood motionless. Then his grip slackened, and she touched his face, the fine, ageless bones. He didn't move. Lo, Vasya said, if I may defer my death an hour, Winter King, I am going to bathe, since you have brought me to a bathhouse. He did not react, but his stillness was answer enough. The inner room was utterly dark, save for the glow of the hot stones in its oven. Vasya left him standing behind her. She was shaken by her own temerity. In a life littered with questionable decisions, she wondered if she was doing the most foolish thing she'd ever done. Determinedly, she stripped off her clothes, laid them in a corner. She ladled water on the rocks and sat, arms wrapped about her knees. But the blissful languor of the heat could not overtake her. She did not know if she was more afraid that he would go away or that he wouldn't. He slipped through the door. She could barely see him in the dark, only knew his presence by the shift of the steam as he moved through it. She lifted her chin to hide sudden fright and said, "Won't you melt?" He looked affronted, but then, unexpectedly, he laughed. I will try not. He sank with undiminished grace onto the bench opposite her, leaned on his knees, his hands laced together. Her glance lingered on his long fingers. His skin was paler than hers. He made nothing of nakedness. His stare was cool and frank. You had a long road, he said. She could not see his eyes in the shadows, but felt his gaze like a hand. Whatever he had not seen of her skin before, he was seeing it now. And it is not over, she said. With unsteady fingers, she touched the scab on her cheek, raised her eyes to his, wondered if she was hideous, wondered if it mattered. Still, he didn't move. The faint light lit him in pieces, a shoulder, a hollow beneath the ribs. She realized that she was considering him, throat to feet, and that he was watching her do so. She blushed. Will you not tell me your secret? He asked. What secret? Retorted Vasya, laboring to keep her voice steady. His hands were motionless, but his glance still traced the lines of her body. I already told you. My people have need of you. He shook his head, raised his eyes to hers. No, there is something more. Something there in your face every time you look at me. As I could, I loved you. My secrets are mine, Gosudar, said Vasya sharply. We sacrifices may take things to the grave as well as anyone else. He lifted a brow. I have never met a maiden who looked less like she meant to die. I don't, said Vasya. Still short of breath, she added, I did want a bath, though, and I am getting one. That is something. He laughed again, and their eyes caught. Him too, Vasya thought. He is afraid too, for he knows no more than I where this will end. Yet he brought me here. He stayed. He wounded me and healed me. He remembers and he doesn't. Before she could lose her nerve, Vasya slipped off the bench and knelt between his knees. His skin had not warmed with the steam. Even in the smoke-smelling bathhouse, the scent of pine, of cold water hung about him. His face did not change, but his breathing quickened. Vasya realized she was trembling. Once again, she reached up, touched her palm to his face. A second time, he caught her wrist, but this time, his mouth grazed the scar in the hollow of her hand. They looked at each other. Her stepmother had liked to frighten her and Irina with tales of wedding night horrors. Dunya had assured her that it was not quite so. It felt like the wildness would burn her up from the inside out. He traced her lower lip with his thumb. She could not read his expression. "Please," she said, or thought she said, just as he closed the distance between them and kissed her. The fire was barely embers in the stove, but they didn't need the light. His skin was cool under her hands. Her sweat streaked them both. She was shivering all over. She didn't know what to do with her hands. It was too much. Skin and spirit, hunger and her desperate loneliness, and the rising tide of feeling between them. Perhaps he felt the uncertainty beneath the desire, for he broke off looking at her. The only sound was their breathing, his as harsh as hers. "Afraid now?" he whispered. He had pulled her with him onto the wooden bench. She was sitting crosswise in his lap, one of his arms about her waist. His free hand drew lines of cool fire on her skin, from ear to shoulder, followed her collarbone, dipped between her breasts. She could not control her breathing. "I'm supposed to be frightened," Vasya snapped, sharper than was warranted because she was, in fact, frightened, and angry too because she could barely think, let alone speak, while his hand came up again and this time slid down her spine, curved lightly around her ribs, found her breast, and lingered there. "I am a maiden, and you..." she trailed off. The light hand stilled.
"Afraid I will hurt you?"
"Do you mean to?" she asked. They both heard the tremor in her voice. Naked in his arms, she was more vulnerable than she'd ever been. But he was afraid too. She felt it in the restrained tension of his touch, could see it now in his black shadowed eyes. Again, they looked at each other. Then he half smiled, and Vasya realized suddenly what the other feeling was, beneath the fear and desire rising between them. It was mad joy. His hand shaped the curve of her waist. He drew her mouth down to his again. His answer was more breath than word, breathed into her ear.
"No, I will not hurt you," he said.
"Vasya," he said into the darkness. They had made it into the outer room in the end. When he'd drawn her down to the floor, it was onto a mound of heaped blankets that smelled like the winter forest. They were beyond speech by then, but it didn't matter. She didn't need words to call him back to her, only the slide of her fingers, the heat of her bruised skin. His hands remembered her when his mind did not. It was in his touch, easing over her half-healed wounds. It was in his grip and the look in his eyes before the candles burned low. Afterward, lying half-drowsing in the dark, she could still feel the pulse of his body in hers and taste the pine on her lips. Then she jerked upright.
"Is it still midnight?" he said. He sounded weary.
"Yes, it is midnight. I will not let you lose it." His voice had changed. He'd said her name.
She rose on one elbow, felt herself blushing.
You remembered.
He said nothing.
You set the bear loose to save my life. Why?
Still, he said nothing.
I came to find you, she said. I learned to do magic. I got the help of the Firebird. You didn't kill me. Stop looking at me like that.
I did not mean, he began, and just like that she was angry, to mask a gathering hurt. He sat up, drew away from her, the line of his spine stiff in the near dark.
I wanted it, she said to his back, trying not to think of every notion of decency she had ever been taught. Chastity, patience, lie with men only for the bearing of children, and above all, do not enjoy it.
I thought you did too, and you... She couldn't say it. Instead, she said,
you remembered. A small enough price for that.
It didn't feel small. He turned so she could see his face. He didn't look as though he believed her. Vasya wished now she were not sitting naked, a hand's breadth away from him. He said, I thank you.
Thank you?
The words struck coldly after the last hour's heat.
Maybe you wish you did not remember, she thought. Part of you was happy here, feared and beloved in this prison.
She didn't say it.
The bear is free in Rus, said Vasya instead. He has set the dead to walking. We must help my cousin, help my brother. I came to get your help.
Still, Morosko said nothing. He had not drawn further away from her, but his glance had turned inward, remote, unreadable. She added with sudden anger,
you owe us your help. You are the reason that the bear is free in the first place. You didn't need to bargain with him. I walked out of the pyre myself.
A little light came into his face.
I wondered if you would, but it was still worth it. When you drew me back to Moscow, I knew then.
Knew what?
That you could be a bridge between men and Cherti, keep us from fading, keep men from forgetting. That we weren't doomed, after all, if you lived, if you came into your power. And I had no other way to save you. I deemed it worth the risk, whatever came after.
You might have trusted me to save myself.
You meant to die. I saw it in you.
She flinched.
Yes, she said softly. I suppose I did mean to die.
Soloveï had fallen. He died under my hands and... She broke off.
But my horse would have called me foolish to give up, so I changed my mind.
The wild simplicity of the night was fading into endless complications. She had never imagined that he'd set his realm and his freedom at hazard purely for love of her. Part of her had wondered anyway. But of course he was king of a hidden kingdom, and he could not make his decision so. It was the power in her blood he'd wanted. She was tired and cold, and she ached. She felt more alone than before. Then she was angry at her own self-pity. For cold, there was a remedy, and damn this new awkwardness between them. She slid again beneath the heavy, heaped-up blankets, turned her back to him. He did not move. She balled her body up on itself, trying to get warm alone. A hand, light as a snowflake, brushed her shoulder. Tears had gathered in her eyes. She tried to blink them away. It was too much. His presence, cold and quiet, the reasonable and practical explanations, to contrast with the overwhelming memory of passion.
No. He said, do not grieve tonight, Vasya.
You would never have done it, she said, not looking at him. This... A vague gesture took in the bathhouse, them. If you had been able to remember who I was, you would never have saved my life if I hadn't been... His hand left her shoulder.
I tried to let you go, he said, again... And again I tried.
because every time I touched you, even looked at you, it drew me nearer to mortality. I was afraid, and yet I could not. He broke off, continued. Perhaps if you hadn't been what you are, I would have found it in myself to let you die. But I heard you scream. Through all the mists of my weakness, after the fire in Moscow, I heard you. I told myself I was being practical. I told myself you were our last hope. I told myself that. But I thought of you in the fire. Vasya turned to face him. He shut his lips tight, as though he'd said more than he wished. And now? She asked. We are here, he said simply. I am sorry, she said. I didn't know how else to bring you back. There was no other way. Why do you think my brother had such faith in his prison? He knew of no tie strong enough to draw me back to myself. Nor did I. Morozko didn't sound happy about it. It occurred to Vasya that he might feel just as she did, raw. She put out a hand. He did not look at her, but his fingers closed about hers. I am still afraid, he said. It was a truth, baldly offered. I am glad you are alive. I am glad to see you again, against all hope. But I do not know what to do. I am afraid too, she said. His fingertips found her wrist, where the blood surged against her skin. Are you cold? She was, but... I think, he said wryly, all things considered, we should be able to share the same blankets a few hours more. We must go, said Vasya. There is too much to do. There is not time. An hour or three won't make a great difference in this country of midnight, said Morozko. You are all worn to shadows, Vasya. It will make a difference, she said. I can't fall asleep here. You can now, he said. I will keep you in midnight. To sleep, to really sleep, Mother of God, she was weary. She was already beneath the blankets. After a moment, he slid beneath them too. Her breath came short. She clenched her fists on an impulse to touch him. They watched each other, warily. He moved first. His hand stole up to her face, traced the sharp line of her jaw, brushed the thick line of the scab from the stone. She shut her eyes. I can heal this for you, he said. She nodded once, vain enough to be glad that at least there would be only a white scar instead of a scarlet one. He cupped his hand, trickled water onto her cheek, while she set her teeth against the flare of agony. Tell me, he said after. It is a long story. I assure you, he said, I will not grow old in the telling of it. She told him. She started with the moment he'd left her in the snowstorm in Moscow and finished with Pozhar, Vladimir, her journey into midnight. She was wrung out at the end, but calmer too, as though she'd laid the skeins of her life out neatly, and there was less of a tangle in her soul. When she fell silent, he sighed. I am sorry, he said. For Solovey, I could only watch. And send me your mad brother, she pointed out, and a token. I could have done without your brother, but the carving comforted me. Did you keep it? Yes, she said. It brings him back when I... She trailed off. It was too fresh, still. He tucked a short curl behind her ear, but said nothing. Why are you afraid? She asked him. His hand dropped. She did not think he would answer. When he did, it was so low she barely caught the words. Love is for those who know the griefs of time, for it goes hand in hand with loss. An eternity so burdened would be a torment. And yet, he broke off, drew breath. Yet what else to call it, this terror and this joy? It was harder this time to move close to him. Before, it was uncomplicated,
reckless, joyful. But now emotion freighted the air between them. His skin had warmed with hers beneath the blankets. He might have been a man except for his eyes, ancient and troubled. It was her turn to push his hair back where it fell over his brow. It curled coarse and cold beneath her fingers. She touched the warm place behind his jaw and the hollow of his throat, laid her spread fingers on his chest. He covered her hand with his, traced her fingers, her arm, then her shoulder, slid his hand from spine to waist, as though he meant to learn her body by touch. She made a sound in her throat. The coolness of his breathing touched her lips. She did not know if he had moved, or if she had, to bring them close together. And still his hand moved, gently, coaxing suppleness from her. She couldn't breathe. Now that they were no longer talking, she could feel the tension gathering in him, shoulder to hand, where his fingers dug into her skin. One thing to take the wild stranger to herself. Another to look into the face of an adversary, ally, friend, and... She wound her fingers in his hair. "Come here," she said. "No. Closer." He smiled then, the slow, unknowable smile of the Winter King, but there was a hint of laughter in it she'd never seen. "Be patient," he murmured into her mouth. But she could not an instant more. Rather than answer, she caught him by the shoulders and rolled him over. She felt the strength in her body then, saw the shift and play of muscle in the faint candlelight, hers and his. She bent forward to breathe into his ear. "Never give me orders." "Command me then," he whispered back. The words went through her like wine. Her body knew what to do then, even if her mind did not quite, and she took him into herself, snow and cold and power and years and that elusive fragility. He said her name once, and she barely heard, lost as she was. But after, when she lay pliant, curved into his body, she whispered, "You are not alone anymore." "I know," he whispered, "neither are you." And then, finally, she slept. Chapter 18. On the Backs of Magic Horses. He rose from the tangled heap of snow-colored furs some unmarked hours later. She did not hear him go, but felt his absence. It was still midnight. She opened her eyes, shivering, and sat up. For an instant, she did not know where she was. Then she remembered and lurched to her feet, afraid. He was gone. He had vanished into the night. She had dreamed it all. She seized hold of herself. Would he really vanish without a word? She didn't know. The madness had gone from her. She was only cold now, teeth set against a rush of shame. The voices of her upbringing sounded loud in her ears, all of them accusing. Teeth sunk into her lower lip. She went to retrieve her clothes. Damn this shame and damn the darkness. She turned her head, and light flared all at once from the candle in the wall niche. Lighting it shook her not at all, as though her mind had accepted at last a world where she could make things burn. Groping, she found her shift, drew it over her head. She was standing in the doorway between rooms, undecided and chilly, when the outer door opened. The candlelight highlighted the bones of him and filled his face with shadows. He had the bundle of her boy's clothes in his hands. She caught the sound of voices and crunching footsteps outside the bathhouse. Fear filled her, unbidden. "What is happening outside?" He looked rueful. "I think that between us we have sealed the murky reputation of bathhouses." Vasya said nothing. In her mind, she was hearing again the sound of the mob in Moscow. She saw him understand.
You were alone then, Vasya, he said. Now you are not. She had both hands on the inner doorframe as if men were coming in to drag her out. Even then, you still walked out of the fire. It cost me, she said, but the gnarled hand of fear loosened its grip on her throat. The village isn't angry, Morozko said. They are delighted. There is power in this night. She felt a blush creeping along her cheekbones. Do you wish to stay? It is hard for me to linger now. She paused. It must be like coming to a place that had been home, but wasn't anymore. Like trying to fit back into a skin already shed. Do your lands border my great-grandmother's? Vasya asked him suddenly. They do, said Morozko. How do you think my table once had strawberries for you, and pears, and snowdrops?
So you knew the story, she pressed, of the witch and her twin girls. You knew Tamara was my grandmother.
I did, he said. He looked wary now. And before you ask, no, I never meant to tell you. Not until the night of the snowstorm in Moscow. And by then it was too late. The witch herself was either dead or lost in midnight. No one knew what had become of the twins, and I could remember nothing of the sorcerer, who had made magic to set himself apart from death. All these things I learned later.
And you thought me only a child, a tool to your purposes.
Yes, he said. Whatever he thought or felt or hoped was buried deep and locked tight. I am not a child anymore, she might have said, but the truth of that was written in his eyes on her. Never lie to me again, she said instead. I will not. Will the bear know you are free? No, he said, unless midnight tells him. I don't think she will meddle so, said Vasya. She watches.
In his silence this time, she could hear a thought unspoken. Tell me, she said.
You needn't go back to Moscow, he said. You've seen enough horror and caused enough pain. The bear will do his best to see you slain now, the worst death he can devise, especially if he finds out I remembered. He knows I would grieve.
It doesn't matter, she said.
It is our fault he is free. He must be bound again. With what? Morozko demanded.
The candle leaped up with a violet flame. His eyes were the color of the fire. His outlines seemed to fade until he was wind and night made flesh. Then he shook off the mantle of power and said, I am winter. Do you think I will have any power in summertime Moscow?
You needn't make it cold in here to score a point, said Vasya resentfully. We have to do something.
She took her own clothes from his hands. Thank you for these, she added, and went to the inner room to dress. At the threshold, she called back, Can you even go out into the summertime world, Winter King? His voice behind her was reluctant.
I don't know. Perhaps. For a little time, if we are together. The necklace is destroyed, but...
But we don't need it anymore, she finished, realizing. The tie between them now, layers of passion and anger, fear and fragile hope, was stronger than any magical jewel. Dressed, she returned to the doorway. Morozko was standing where she'd left him.
We could perhaps get to Moscow, but to what end, he said. If the bear finds out we are coming, he will delight in setting a trap, so that I must watch, helpless, while you are slain. Or perhaps one where you must watch while your family suffers.
We will just have to be clever, said Vasya. We got Muscovy into this. We are going to get her out.
We ought to return to my own lands. Come to him in winter when I am stronger. Then we'd have a chance of victory.
He surely knows that, Vasya returned, which means that whatever he is planning, he must do it this summer.
It might be your undoing.
She shook her head. It might, but I'm not going to abandon my family. Will you come with me?
I have said you are not alone, Vasya, and I meant it, he said, but he sounded unhappy. She managed the ghost of a smile. You are not alone either. By all means, let us continue repeating it until one of us believes it. Briskly, she managed to say without tremor, if I go out there, will the village try to kill me? No, said Morozko, and then he smiled. But a legend might be born. She flushed, but when he extended a hand, she took it. The village had indeed gathered outside the bathhouse. They drew back when the door opened. Their eyes rode from Vasya to Morozko, handfast, disheveled. Yelena stood at the front of the crowd, shoulder to shoulder with a man who had tried to save her. She flinched when Morozko turned to her. It was to Yelena that the frost demon spoke, although the whole village heard. Forgive me, he said. She looked shocked. Then she gathered her dignity and bowed. It was your right, but... She looked more closely at his face. You are not the same, she whispered. Just as Vasya had seen the years gone from his eyes, this woman could sense the weight of their return. No, said Morozko. I have been saved from forgetfulness. He glanced at Vasya and spoke so that the whole village heard. I loved her, and a curse made me forget. But she came for me and broke the curse, and now I must go. My blessing on you all this winter. Whispers of wonder, even joy. Yelena smiled. We are doubly blessed, she said to Vasya. Sister. She had a gift in her hands, a magnificent long cloak, wolf without, rabbit within. She gave it to Vasya, embraced her. Thank you, she whispered. May I have your blessing on my firstborn? Health and long life, said Vasya a little awkwardly. For your child, joy in love, and a brave death, a long time from now. Zimnyaya Korolyeva, they said, the Winter Queen. It frightened her. She tried to compose her features. Morozko stood beside her, deceptively calm, but she could sense the feeling rushing between him and his people. A pull like a current. His eyes were a deep and astonishing blue. Perhaps he wished even now to go back, to take his place in the feasting, to feed forever on this worship. But if he doubted his course, he did not let it show on his face. Vasya was relieved when all the people turned at the sound of hoofbeats. The light bloomed on a dozen faces. Two horses came flowing over the palisade, one white and one gold. They cut through the crowd and trotted up to the two of them. Morozko, without a word, leaned his forehead against the neck of the white mare. The horse put her head around and lipped at his sleeve. Pain shot through Vasya seeing it. I forgot you too, he said to the mare low. Forgive me. The white mare shoved him with her head, ears back. I don't know why any of us waited for you. It was very dark. Pojar scraped a hoof in the snow in obvious agreement. You waited as well, Vasya said to her, surprised. Pojar bit Vasya on the arm and stamped, I am not waiting again. Vasya said, rubbing the new bruise, I am glad to see you, lady. Morozko said in some wonder, she has never taken a rider willingly in all the years of her life. She has not taken one now, said Vasya hastily, but she helped to guide me here. I am grateful. She scratched Pojar's withers. Pojar, despite herself, leaned into the scratches. You took too long, said the mare again, just to show she didn't in any way enjoy being coddled, and stamped again. Vasya's new cloak lay heavy on her shoulders. Farewell, she said to the people. They were round-eyed with wonder. They think they see a miracle, Vasya said low to Morozko. It doesn't feel like one. And yet, he replied, a girl alone rescued the Winter King from forgetfulness and stole him away with magic horses. That is miracle enough for one midwinter.
Vasya found herself smiling as he vaulted to the white mare's back. Before he could offer, or not offer, to take her up before him, she said firmly, I am going to walk. I came here on my own feet, after all. Walking had been a slogging nightmare of deep snow without snowshoes, but she didn't say that. The pale eyes considered her. Vasya wished he wouldn't. He so obviously saw past her pride, not wanting to be carried away across his saddle bow to the deeper emotion. The shock of Solovey breaking, falling, was still too raw in memory. It felt wrong now to ride away in triumph. Very well, he said, and surprised her by dismounting. You needn't, she said. The two horses' bodies shielded them from the crowd. You can't mean to march out of the village like a cowherd. It is beneath your dignity. I have seen uncounted dead, he returned coolly, touched them, sent them on. But I have never done anything to remember them. I can walk now with you, because you cannot ride Solovey beside me, because he was brave and he is gone. She hadn't wept for Solovey, not properly. She had dreamed of him, waked screaming for him to run, felt his absence as a dull, poisonous ache. But she hadn't wept, except for a few quelled tears after she nearly slew the mushroom spirit. Now she felt the tear starting, stinging. Lightly, Morosko touched his finger to the first as it ran down to her jaw. It froze at his touch, fell away. Somehow the act of walking out of that midnight village, while the horses paced beside them, drove home Solovey's loss in a way that none of the last day's shocks had. When they had passed the palisade and gone back into the winter forest, Vasya buried her face in the white mare's mane, and she cried all the dammed-up tears that one night in Moscow had left inside her. The mare stood patiently, blowing warm air onto her hands, and Morosko waited, silent, except that once he laid cool fingers on the back of her neck. When at last her tears quieted, she shook her head, wiped her running nose, and tried to think clearly. We have to go back to Moscow, her voice was hoarse. As you say, he said. He still didn't look happy about it, but he didn't object again. If we are going all the way back to Moscow, the white mare put in unexpectedly, then Vasya must get on my back. I can carry both of you. It will be quicker. Vasya had her lips open in a refusal, but then she noticed Morosko's expression. She will not let you say no, he said mildly, and she is right. You will only exhaust yourself walking. It is you who must hold Moscow in your mind. If I guide us, it will be winter when we arrive. At least they were out of sight of the village now. Vasya vaulted to the mare's back, and Morosko got on behind her. The white mare was more finely built than Solovey, but the way she moved reminded her. Trying not to think of the bay stallion, Vasya looked down at Morosko's hand, lying relaxed on his knee, remembered instead his hands on her skin, his hair coarse and cold, tumbled dark across her breasts. She shivered at the memory and pushed it away too. They had stolen those hours in midnight. Now they must think only of outmaneuvering a clever and implacable enemy. But, for distraction, she forced herself to ask a question whose answer she feared. To bind the bear, must I sacrifice myself as my father did? Morosko did not immediately say no. Vasya began to feel a little sick to her stomach. The mare set off lightly through the snow. More snow drifted down from the sky. Vasya wondered if he called it down in his distress, if it were involuntary,
like the beat of a heart. You promised you'd not lie to me again, said Vasya. I will not, said Morozko. It is not so simple as exchanging your life for his binding, the two things interchangeable. Your life is not tied to the bear's liberty. You are not just a token in our war. She waited. But I gave him power over me, said Morozko, when I yielded up my freedom. My twin and I will not be equals in a fight now. The words came out gratingly. Summer is his season. I do not know how to bind him, except with the power of a life freely given, or a trick. Pojar said suddenly, What about the golden thing? The mare had drifted close enough to catch their conversation. Vasya blinked. What golden thing? The mare threw her head up and down. The golden thing the sorcerer made. When I wore it, I couldn't fly. I had to do what he said. It is powerful, that thing. Vasya and Morozko looked at each other. Kasche's golden bridle, said Vasya slowly. If it bound her, might it bind your brother? Perhaps, said the Winter King, brows drawn together. It was in Moscow, said Vasya, speaking faster and faster in her excitement. In the stable, Dmitri Ivanovich's stable. I pulled it off her head and threw it down the night Moscow burned. Is it still in the palace? Perhaps it melted in the fire. It would not have melted, Morozko said. There is a chance. She could not see his face, but his hand on his knee closed slowly into a fist. Vasya, without thinking, leaned over and scratched Pojar's neck with delight. Thank you, she said. The mare tolerated it a moment before she sidled away. Part 4 Chapter 19 Allies. Summer came with unnatural suddenness, fell on Moscow like a conquering army. Fires broke out in the forest, so that the city was palled with smoke and no one could see the sun. Folk went mad from the heat, drowned themselves in the river seeking coolness, or simply dropped where they stood, scarlet-faced, bodies dewed with clammy sweat. The rats came with a warmth, creeping out of the merchant boats while men unloaded silver and cloth and forged iron for the sticky, sweltering markets of Moscow. They thrived in the smother, drawn to the reek of Moscow's middens. The first folk to fall sick lived in the posad, the airless, crowded huts by the river. They began to cough, to sweat, and then to shiver. Then the smooth swellings showed, at throat and groin, and then black spots. Plague. The word rippled through the city. Moscow had seen plague before. Dmitri's uncle Semyon had died of it, with his wife and his sons, in one terrible summer. Close up the houses of the sick, said Dmitri to the captain of his guard. They are not to go out. No, not even to go to church. If a priest can be found to bless them, let the priest go in, but that is all. Tell the guards at the city gate. Anyone who seems ill is not allowed within the walls. Folk still whispered in hushed tones of the death of Dmitri's uncle, dying swollen like a tick, black-spotted, his own attendants afraid to come near him. The man nodded, but he was frowning. What? Dmitri demanded. The night of the Tatar attack had decimated Dmitri's city guard. In the aftermath of the riot and Vasya's burning, he'd built it up again, larger than before, but they were still inexperienced. This sickness is the curse of God, Gosudar, said the captain. Surely it is only right that men be allowed to go and pray. All the people's prayers together may yet reach the ears of the Almighty. It is a curse that flies from man to man, said Dmitri. What are the walls of Moscow for, if not to keep out evil? One of his boyars, there in his anteroom, said, Forgive me, Gosudar, but... Dmitri turned, scowling. Can I not give orders without debate from half the city?
Ordinarily, he humored his boyars. They were mostly older than he, and had ensured that he had a throne to inherit when he came of age. But the shocking heat sapped his strength and brought on a sick, weary anger. He'd had no word from either of his cousins. The Prince of Serpukhov had taken all the silver Muscovy could muster, and had gone south to plead their case before the Temnik Mamai. Sasha was supposed to be bringing back Father Sergei, but Sasha had not returned, and reports came out of the south that Mamai was still gathering up his Yulus, as though he'd never heard Vladimir's message at all.
The people are afraid, said the boyar carefully. Thrice have the dead come walking since the season turned. Now this, if you shut the gates of Moscow and deny church to the sick, I do not know what they will do. Already there is much talk that the city is cursed.
Dmitri understood war and the managing of men, but curses were outside his experience.
I will take thought for the comfort of the city, he said, but we are not cursed.
In his own heart, though, Dmitri wasn't sure. He wanted Father Sergei's advice, but the old monk was not there. So instead, grudgingly, the Grand Prince turned to his steward.
Send for Father Constantine.
The fair-haired prince is no fool, said the bear, but he is young. He has sent a messenger for you. When you go to him, you must convince him to let you give service in the cathedral. Call the people together and pray for rain or salvation or whatever it is men ask of their gods in this age. But call them together.
Constantine was alone in the scriptorium of the archangel, wearing only the lightest of cassocks. Sweat dewed his forehead, his upper lip.
I am painting, he said.
He turned a pot of color in the light. His colors lay before him like a string of jewels. Some were actually made from precious stones. At Lesnaya Zemlya, he had made his colors from bark and berries and leaves. Now anxious boyars showered him with lapis for his blues and jasper for his reds. They paid the finest silversmiths in Moscow to make icon covers for him of hammered silver studded with pearls. The third time dead things came whispering through the streets, it had taken the whole night to drive them off, first one, then another, and finally a third.
It cannot seem to be too easy, the bear had told him afterward, when Constantine had wakened screaming from a dream of dead faces. Do you think the defeat of a single child upir would have been enough to win over all Moscow, peasant and boyar? Drink wine, man of God, and do not fear the darkness. Have I not done all I promised?
Every last thing, Constantine had said miserably, shivering in his cooling sweat.
He was to be made bishop. He had been granted property commensurate with his dignity. The people of Moscow worshipped him with wild-eyed fervor, but that did not help him in the night when he dreamed dead hands reaching. Now, in the scriptorium, Constantine turned away from his wooden panel, found the devil standing just behind him. His breath left him silently. He could never get used to the demon's presence. The beast knew his thoughts, waked him from nightmares, whispered advice in his ear. Constantine would never be free of him.
Perhaps I don't wish to be, Constantine thought in his more clear-headed moments.
Always, when he met the devil's single eye, the creature stared steadily back. The beast saw him. Constantine had waited to hear the voice of God for so long, but God was silent. This devil never stopped talking. Nothing would quiet Constantine's nightmares, though. He tried drinking mead to thicken his sleep, but the honey wine only made his head ache.
Finally, in desperation, Constantine asked the monks for brushes and wooden panels, for oil and water and pigment, and set himself to writing icons. When he painted, his soul seemed to exist only in his eye and hand. His mind went quiet.
"I can see you are painting," said the bear with an edge, "in a monastery, alone. Why? I thought you wanted earthly glories, man of God."
Constantine swept his arm at the image on the panel.
"I have my earthly glories, and this? Is it not glorious too?"
His voice was thick with bitter irony, the icon painted by a man without faith. The bear peered over Constantine's shoulder.
"That is a strange picture," he said.
His thick finger went out to trace the image. The image was of Saint Peter. He was dark-haired and wild-eyed, hands and feet streaming blood. His eyes turned blindly to heaven, where angels waited. But the angels had eyes as flat and inimical as the swords in their hands. The host welcoming the apostle to heaven looked more like an army holding the gates. Peter had not the serene look of a saint. His eyes saw, his hands gestured, expressive. He was as alive as Constantine's gift, and the raw, wretched hunger the priest could not uproot from his soul could make him.
"It is very beautiful," said the bear. His finger traced over the lines without quite touching. He looked almost perplexed. "How do you make it live so? You have not magic." "I don't know," said Constantine. "My hands move without me. What do you know of beauty, monster?" "More than you," said the bear. "I have lived longer and seen more. I can make dead things live, but only in mockery of the living. This is something else."
Was that wonder in that sardonic single eye? Constantine couldn't be sure. The bear reached out and turned the icon's wooden panel to the wall.
"You still must go and give service in the cathedral. Have you forgotten our bargain?"
Constantine threw his brush aside.
"What if I don't? Will you damn me? Steal my soul? Put me to torture?" "No," said the bear, and touched his cheek lightly. "I will disappear. Be gone. Fling myself back into the fiery pit and leave you all alone."
Constantine stood still.
Alone? Alone with his thoughts?
Sometimes this devil seemed like the only thing real in this hot, nightmarish world.
"Don't leave me," said Constantine.
It came out a grinding whisper. The thick fingers stroked his face with surprising delicacy. Eyes wide and densely blue rose to meet a single gray eye. A face seamed with scars. The bear breathed his answer into Constantine's ear.
"I was alone for 100 lives of men, bound in a clearing beneath an unchanging sky. You can make life with your hands of a kind I've never seen. Why would I ever leave you?"
Constantine did not know whether to be relieved or terrified.
"But," murmured the bear, "the cathedral."
Dmitri didn't agree.
"Divine service for all Moscow?" he asked. "Father, be reasonable. Folk will faint from the heat or perhaps be trampled. Feelings are running high enough already without calling everyone together to sweat and pray and kiss icons, pleasing as it may be to God."
This last was tacked on as an afterthought. The bear, watching invisibly, said with satisfaction,
"I do love sensible men. They always try to make sense of the impossible, and they can't. Then they blunder. Come now, little father. Blind him with eloquence."
Constantine gave no sign he heard, beyond a tightening of his mouth. But aloud he said, reproof in his tone,
It is God's will, Dmitri Ivanovich. If there is any chance to lift this curse from Moscow, we must take it. The dead are infecting Moscow with fear. And what if I am called too late? What if worse comes than Upiri, and my prayers do not stop it? No. I think it better that the whole city pray together, and perhaps make an end of this curse.
Dmitri was frowning still, but he agreed. To Constantine, the world seemed less real when he donned his new robes of white and scarlet, his collar high and stiffened in the back. Sweat ran like rivers down his spine as he put a hand to the door of the sanctuary. The bear said, "I wish to go in."
"Then go in," said Constantine, his mind elsewhere.
The devil made a sound of impatience and took Constantine's hand.
"You must bring me with you."
Constantine's hand curled in the demon's. "Why can't you go in yourself?"
"I am a devil," said the bear, "but I am also your ally, man of God."
Constantine drew the bear into the sanctuary with him and gave the icons a spiteful look.
"See what I do when you will not speak to me?"
The bear looked about him curiously, at the gilding and jeweled icon covers, at the scarlet and blue of the ceiling, at the people. For the cathedral was packed with people, a shoving, swaying throng, smelling of sour sweat. Crammed together before the icon screen, they wept and they prayed, watched over by the saints, and also by a silent devil with one eye. For the bear walked out with the clergy when the doors of the iconostasis were thrown open. Surveying the crowd, he said,
"This bodes well. Come now, man of God. Show me your quality."
When he began the service, Constantine did not know whom he chanted for, the watching throng or the listening demon. But he flung all the torment of his tattered soul into it until the whole cathedral wept. Afterward, Constantine went back to his cell in the monastery, kept against the furnishing of his own house, and lay down, wordless, in his sweat-soaked linen. His eyes were shut, and the bear did not speak, but he was there. Constantine could feel the dazzling, sulphurous presence. Finally, the priest burst out without opening his eyes.
"Why are you silent? I did what you asked."
The bear said, almost growling,
"You have been painting the things you will not say, shame and sorrow and all the tedious rest. It is all there in your St. Peter's face, and today you sang what you cannot bring yourself to utter. I could feel it. What if someone realizes? Are you trying to break your promise?"
Constantine shook his head, his eyes still shut.
"They will hear what they want to hear and see what they want to see," he said. "Make what I feel their own without understanding." "Well then," said the bear, "men are great fools."
He let it go.
"In any case, that scene in the cathedral should make enough."
Now he sounded pleased.
"Enough what?" said Constantine.
The sun had gone down by then. The green dusk brought some respite from the savage heat. He lay still, breathing, seeking in vain a breath of cool air.
"Enough dead," said the bear unsparing. "They all kissed the same icon. I have use for the dead. Tomorrow you have to go to the Grand Prince. Secure your place with him. That monk of witches getting, Brother Alexander, he is going to come back. You must see to it that his place by the Grand Prince's side is not waiting for him."
Constantine lifted his head.
"The monk and the Grand Prince have been friends from boyhood." "Yes," said the bear, "and the monk saw fit to lie to Dmitri more than once. Whatever stiff-necked oaths he has sworn since, I assure you, It will not be enough to get back the prince's trust. Or is it harder than setting a mob to kill a girl?
She deserved it, Constantine muttered, throwing an arm over his eyes. The blackness behind his